Maine's extraordinary trees, their diversity, and threats to some species. Here's a statistic you can impress people with. Guess how many trees there are in Maine. Ready? Well, according to the Maine Forest Service, the number is 23.5 billion. That's right, we have more than 23 billion trees in a state with 1.3 million people. We love our trees, from the white pine, which is the Maine state tree, to the spectacular maples that give us syrup, the birch stands, and the glorious old oak trees in so many towns, quaking aspen, the list goes on. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn more about Maine's extraordinary diversity of trees and threats to our trees, from climate change to invasive species, including the devastating emerald ash borer. Trees, next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine is known for its trees, and today we are going to learn a lot more about them, including threats to our beloved tree species. My guests are both from Maine's Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Patty Cormier is our state forester, and Allison Canody is our state entomologist. We invite your questions and comments. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Patty, I'm going to start with you. I still cannot get over a statistic that I learned this morning, the statistic that we have 23.5 billion trees in Maine. I can't get my head around that number. How do you figure that out?
That's a great number, and it's a great question. Thanks for having me on. So we have around 3,500 forest inventory plots around the state, and a certain portion of them are measured every year. And so that is from that information. That is true information from plot inventory that are scattered throughout the state. And it's an amazing number. I mean, look at, we're 89% forested. It's the identity of Maine, right? And it just makes for, we're the largest contiguous block of forest land east of the Mississippi. And I think every Mainer should be very proud of that number.
Wow. And talk about the variety of tree species. From the window where I'm sitting right now, I see ash and oak and spruce and fir. And I live in a neighborhood. how many species do we have? How many are native and how many non-native?
So with our inventory, it shows we're looking at 50 to 60 native species. And unfortunately, the non-native number is growing, and you're absolutely right. You can have a number of trees on looking out your window and just right outside your door, and that's what we have such a resilient ecosystem here, then that's because of that diversity. But we are, the invasive species coming in is definitely a trouble, something we're very worried about.
Well, let me turn to you, Allison, to talk about that. We have known that the emerald ash borer is coming, and now we know that it's here. Give us a sense of where it is now, why people like you are so concerned about it, and what people need to be thinking about and doing right now here in March of 2021.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer. So, yeah, the emerald ash borer was found in Maine in 2018, and it was actually found in two really separated places. So it was found way up north in Madawaska first, actually, and that was adjacent to an infestation that had been discovered in Canada. And then also way down south in on the western border of York County. So since then, we continue to find new infested areas within those two regions, so both up in far northern Maine in Arista County and also in southern Maine. We have found infested trees in Cumberland County, in several towns in Cumberland County now, and also throughout York County. So it is something that is spreading, but at this point we still have more than 90% of our ash resource is outside of known infested areas. So there's still a lot of ash in Maine that is not impacted. And so that's why we're concerned, is we want to continue to slow the spread of emerald ash borer into that ash resource. Emerald ash borer will kill most of the ash in Maine. There's no question about that. And what people can do in order to help slow the spread is they can keep their firewood local, so use only local firewood or heat-treated firewood. They can help to look for emerald ash borer. This is a great time of year to do that. You know, the sun is starting to get strong. It's really nice to be outside in this weather, and the woodpeckers have been active all year round, and all winter long. And one of the things that they do is they look for the larvae underneath the bark of the ash trees. And so if you see ash trees that have been pecked at by woodpeckers, then there's a chance that they might have emerald ash borer in them, especially if there's been a lot of woodpecker activity in those trees. And we're starting to see signs like that in York County that are readily visible from, you know, a moving car or as people are out exercising in the spring weather.
And Allison, I want to jump on a couple things you said. You said we know that emerald ash borer will affect most of the ash trees in Maine. And when you say affect, you mean kill. I mean, 10, 20 years from now, we're going to have an entirely different canopy here in Maine.
Yeah, so ash is really vulnerable to emerald ash borer attack. There is some resistance or tolerance in some white ash, not a lot. There's almost no tolerance of attack in some of our other species, especially brown ash, but also green ash as well has less tolerance of attack than white ash. So we do expect ash to be at least, you know, functionally really reduced in the ecosystem compared to what it is now.
But people can treat it. We have a big, beautiful ash tree in our yard, and I'm having someone come treat that in hopes of saving it. What are my chances of saving this ash tree if I have it treated before it's infected?
So we do know that insecticides are effective against emerald ash borer. There's no question about that. And we do also think that it may be possible to eventually spread out treatment of those ash trees, so you don't have to treat them as frequently once the peak of the emerald ash borer population passes. Once they've killed most of the ash in the forest, those landscape and street trees that have been treated may be able to be treated on a much less frequent basis. But yes, insecticides are effective in controlling emerald ash borer even after initial attack. So if you're watching your trees and know how to recognize the signs of emerald ash borer attack, then you can preserve their health.
All right. And Allison, let me ask you, the other invasive insect that people are really paying close attention is the brown-tailed moth. What is the latest on that?
So brown-tailed moth is at historic population levels. We're in the middle of an outbreak. We mapped over 150,000 acres of damage last year. Both that's combined acres, from a July aerial survey flights and also late August, early September aerial survey flights. And those covered or were found in areas from Cumberland County through Hancock County. In addition, we have seen the overwintering webs from Fort Fairfield to Bethel in every county of the state. So this is the first year in a very long time that we've seen them in counties like Aroostook County or Somerset County, County.
And remind us, what does brown-tail moth affect? What kind of trees? Is it more than one species? And getting the brown-tail moth itself being itchy to the skin, what about the trees? Does it kill them?
So brown-tail moth affects more than one kind of tree. It tends to prefer the oaks here in Maine and also trees and shrubs that are in the rose family. So things like your service berries and apples and hawthorns are also impacted by brown-tail moth. But it is kind of not a picky eater. It'll get onto other hardwood trees and shrubs. So you'll see it sometimes in poplar and birch and elm. It's really not much of a surprise to see them in those. It will not get into conifers. So if you have a lot of conifers around your house, then it limits your impacts from brown-tail moth. And will it kill the trees? It can with populations that remain high for a number of years, and especially if there's other stress factors like those late season droughts that we've been having in the growing season the last several years really contributed to the decline of oaks in areas affected by brown-tail moth.
Well, we are talking about the trees of Maine. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-399-3566, send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to go a little broader here, Patty, and I want to ask you if you can give us a little lesson on how tree species evolved to be so different. Why do some trees have a rougher bark or oddly shaped leaves, for example?
Sure. I love this question. This is one of my all-time favorite things with trees. So, yeah, you look at the expression of trees. Look at how many factors you can look at to tell the difference. And really, it all comes down to kind of the ecological evolution of trees. And the limiting factors are light, water, and, of course, freezing temperatures. So when you look at, we'll look at shapes of leaves, they're, when you look at hardwood trees, which are the trees that they're deciduous, they lose their leaves in the fall. So they're looking at, hey, I'm going to make a big surface and collect as much light as I can, but I don't want to lose moisture. So those lobes, you see, so when I say lobes, think of an oak tree, and it has what we call lobes, like or a maple tree. It has five sugar maple, five letters in the word sugar, five lobes. And so it's a way to reduce the heat loss, but collect the sun. And every leaf is a little factory, and trees are just amazing that way. And, you know, there's other features that this evolution of species and their expression is also how you can tell them apart. So look at birch trees, white birch. Why are they white? Well, that their survival technique is that, think of in the summer, in the hot summer, you're going to wear white clothing, right, to reflect the light. Well, that's part of why they're white. Or look at beech trees in the winter. Those are trees that they kind of keep their leaves dead on the tree, and that's because they have a lot of tannins in them, and that's kind of a survival factor, that those tannins provide fungal properties that protect them. So you think of softwood trees. So those are coniferous. They have needles. Each needle is a leaf. And when you look at where the softwood trees mostly are Maine, part of the boreal forest, they keep their leaves or needles all year round. So they can photosynthesize when the temperatures are right, even in the winter. So that's their survival technique. And there's so many other, it's an interesting topic. You know, you're looking at the size of the color, the arrangement on the twig, buds, big and sticky like balsam poplar, and that's to attract insects. When they leaf out, that's a factor. Why does ash leaf out later than other species? And it's all because of that survival, and winter and cold temperatures are the limiting factor there. I could take the whole hour talking about this.
Well, I'm going to go right now, though, to Todd Robbins, who is the tree warden for the town of Cape Elizabeth and the owner of TMR Property Services. Thanks so much for calling in, Todd. And tell us what exactly it means to be a tree warden for a town. And are there many of you?
Sure. And thank you very much for having me. I am the tree warden of Cape Elizabeth, and with my duties that pretty much puts me in charge of all town trees, right-of-ways, public areas, just all things trees in Cape Elizabeth, pruning, takedowns, IPM, replanting. And, yeah, it just pretty much puts me in charge of all that. I believe most towns or cities either have tree wardens or town arborists, as they were.
And I know that, Todd, because I've met you, that you are really working to make sure that there's a healthy mix of trees in Cape Elizabeth. And right now there's a bit of an imbalance, as I imagine there are in many Maine towns, because of what people have planted over the years, what people have been enthusiastic about over the years. What are there too many of, and what would you like to see more of? And why does it matter?
Well, so it's interesting. Every town is going to have a different number of species percentage wise of an urban canopy. And one rule, arborist rule, that some people, town arborists and tree wardens go use is called a 10-20-30 rule. And what that is you don't want more than 10% of a given species, 20% of a given genus, or 30% of a given family within that urban canopy. Now, here in Cape, we do not have a street tree inventory, but some towns do. Some towns are lucky enough to have those street tree inventories. So in Cape, it's a bit of a guesstimate, but our guess is that we actually might have upwards of 35-40% red oak, which is a species. So if you're looking to have a 10% or under of a species, we unfortunately here have upwards, like I said, of 30-40%. So you don't want to go around removing well-established trees to plant non-established trees. So what you want to do is when there is a need to take a tree down, or there is a space to fill with a tree, you maybe just do a little bit of research. Native is good, and when I say native, I mean native to the Northeast, not necessarily native to Maine, because you're really restricting yourself if you're just native to Maine. Here in Cape Elizabeth, I have, within the ordinance, I do have a list of what I consider, native to the Northeast trees, and maybe just take a look at those and see if those are, good for your property, or in my case, good for the town. So those will be trees that I use to kind of get things more in balance.
Sure. And I know, before I let you go, I know that you have a couple favorites. Tell us what you like to plant.
Oh my gosh. And this is a good question for any tree person, because it tells you a lot about the person. my favorite tree is the catalpa, the northern catalpa. And that is one of my native trees here that I like to use. And the other is a shagbark hickory. Both of them are very handsome trees in the winter time. They're good all year round. They have interest, whether it be flower or fruit or bark. They're always just really something nice to look at. So those are two native trees in Maine. If you're looking to put a tree on your property and make sure you put it in the right place, catalpa or a shagbark hickory is a really good choice.
Well, Todd, thanks so much for calling in and joining the conversation. Todd Robbins is the tree warden for the town of Cape Elizabeth, and we do need to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bangor Savings Bank, committed to supporting the health and financial well-being of their customers with more ways to bank, bangor.com/moreways, and Center for an Ecology-Based Economy's virtual convergence, Climate Action to Climate Justice, starting March 14th.
Men have walked the moon. By 2024, the first woman could too.
I wouldn't want to be the first person just for me. It would be really to pay homage to these other women that came before me, and to continue to celebrate them, and to continue to inspire all of those in the next generation.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, we'll hear from astronaut Jessica Meir about NASA's planned mission to the moon. Please join us.
And Next is coming up today at 2 on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is a media sponsor of the Maine Science Festival, celebrating Maine science and the people who do it. From now through March 24th, the Maine Science Festival is hosting a series of online forums to hear from leaders in science, engineering, and innovation. The next forum, how Maine's non-biological sciences companies and organizations stepped up, will take place on Wednesday afternoon, March 17th. For complete details and to reserve your spot, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding and Appreciating the Trees of Maine. Joining me, Patty Cormier, who is Director of the Maine Forest Service, and Allison Canody, Director of Forest Health and Monitoring with the Maine Forest Service. Both are with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. You can share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Nancy Olmsted, who is an invasive plant biologist with the Maine Natural Areas Program, part of the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Nancy, thanks so much for calling in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you heard us talking to Todd Robbins before the break, but I put him on the spot and I asked him what his favorite trees are. I'm going to start by asking you that because I know that you like native trees.
Yeah, you're right. Thanks, Jennifer. One of my favorite native trees is the eastern hemlock. This is a beautiful conifer tree with short needles, and it tends to occur in steep places, often in places that have streams and brooks running through them. And I really love the experience of being underneath an eastern hemlock canopy. It tends to be really open with maybe just a few little wildflowers or small shrubs in the understory, so you can see for quite a ways. And they're just really quite impressive trees. They can be very broad and tall and cast deep shade. I also, as an invasive plant biologist, love those habitats because they tend to be resistant to invasive plants for some reason, whether it's the deep shade or perhaps the way that the trees acidify the soil. I don't find a lot of invasive plants under the eastern hemlock forest, so that makes me happy too.
Yeah, and so the reason you're calling in, though, is to talk about the invasive plants that threaten our tree species. So tell us, what are the sort of biggest offenders? What do you really want people to be looking out for?
Great question. Yeah, so when trees become full-sized, there is a plant called the Asiatic bittersweet, which is a woody vine, and that vine can climb up into the canopy and put out leaves and cause damage. You know, when we have like a late an early heavy snow, that the weight of the vines and the way they hold their leaves late into the fall can cause snapping and breakage. The vines themselves can also strangle the trees by girdling them. So you may have seen these vines that wrap very tightly around trees. So yeah, once trees are mature, that's one of the invasive plants that can still threaten them. But trees face a lot more threats when they're in their sort of teenage years or when they're, you know, maybe in their elementary school years, when they're saplings and seedlings. There are a number of invasive shrub species, which are very concerning because they outcompete our native tree seedlings and saplings and wildflowers and shrubs. So those plants include the shrub honeysuckles. We have several species of invasive shrub honeysuckles, as well as the Japanese barberry, which is a plant that was widely sold for sort of a thorny hedgerow bush. And also the multiflora rose, which is a rose species. Boy, I could go on, Jennifer.
Well, you know what I'm going to do to you, Nancy? We have a caller, and I think he's going to ask about invasive species. So I'm going to go to him while we still have you on the line. Mike in Clifton, go ahead.
Yes, I was listening to your show a few years back, and you talked about maple sugaring, and somebody called and asked about tapping a Norway maple, and the guest on the show quite tersely remarked that Norway maple is an invasive species. Don't tap it. get rid of it. And I have I happen to have a quite a large one that I planted myself in 1982. It's now probably close to 20 inch diameter. It's quite an impressive shade tree. But it does, however, drop a lot of seedlings that are really quite prevalent around in the springtime. And I can see where it could really take over an area. And because it's proximity to the house, I'm considering cutting it, even though it's a very attractive shade tree. And I just wondered what the opinion is on that particular species and how one should handle that.
Sure. Nancy, is this a question for you?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike, for your question. We do consider Nori maple to be an invasive species just for the reasons that you outlined. It prolifically reproduces. The seedlings are very shade tolerant and can get into our forest understories. It's also somewhat problematic in a planted setting. It tends to crack and split. We've had several taken down in my neighborhood just because they, were getting storm damage at a certain point. So we do consider it an invasive species, and, it is tough with those shade trees when they provide, if they're the only big trees around, I'm very sympathetic. Ideally, we'd run out and plant native trees right away to start to grow and hopefully over time take the place of those non-native invasive trees. Yeah, it's tough, but to have a diversity of trees like Todd was talking about is really a nice thing, especially in this day and age with climate change coming and these threats from invasive pests like the emerald ash borer or the brown-tailed moth or the winter moth. It's great to have a diversity of tree species, native tree species in our landscape, so that hopefully we can still get shade and good habitat for all kinds of creatures.
Thanks for your question, Mike. And thank you, Nancy, for joining us for just a little while. Nancy Olmsted is invasive plant biologist with the Maine Natural Areas Program. So many questions coming in. Let me see. An email from Jean here. Can you speak to the restoration of the American chestnut? I understand there's work on that in Maine. Patty?
Sure. So restoration of the American chestnut has been going on for years and years, in Maine, up to more than 20 years. And there's been many genetic iterations of it, they keep cloning and incorporating some of the European strains for some resistance to the blight. And I think we're at the point now that tree seedlings are being sold. There's the Chestnut Society. They're the place to go. They do sell seedlings, and we're at the point where they're pretty good with having developed a resistant species. And it's any chestnut you do see, usually what I see is they get to 6-7 inches and then they die, and some in the natural environment are resistant as well, but it's looking good. I mean, there's been a lot of work on it, and I'd encourage you to get with the Chestnut Society to look into getting some of those seedlings.
Great. An email here from Ben. We have a mountain ash, rowan, in our yard in Portland, full of woodpecker holes. Are these trees affected by the emerald ash borer as well? Allison?
The answer to that one is actually no. So they're in the rose family, the mountain ash are. And emerald ash borer attacks trees, attacks ash trees. It can actually also attack something called the white fringe tree, which is used sometimes as an ornamental shrub here in Maine. But it cannot attack the rose family hosts or trees. So there are a number of insects that will get into mountain ash. It is one that can be, kind of problematic in a landscape. They tend to live fast and die young, kind of. But they are beautiful, but they do. I mean, if you were to plant one, you should expect to have problems over the years.
And another important bug question. Here's an email from Dora. Is hemlock woolly adelgid still on the march in Maine?
It is. That is a good question. So Hemlock woolly adelgid spread is inevitable. It's something that we try to slow down with a quarantine, but it is inevitable. The insects this time of year and throughout May and June are in both the egg and the crawler stage, and those can be picked up by birds. They can be picked up by storms and moved new places. And so in Maine at this point, most of what we've found as far as hemlock woolly adelgid infestations has been right along the coast, all the way from southern York County through MDI. So just recently we had identification of hemlock woolly adelgid in a forest stand in Hancock County. It was the first one last year. But we have seen planted trees all the way out to Lubeck and inland to places like Bangor and those sorts of things. So it is important not to move hemlock seedlings outside of the areas known to have hemlock woolly adelgid and outside of the areas within the hemlock woolly adelgid quarantine, because that's a sure way to move them. But also just be aware that this time of year you can carry it with you to new places. So if you're recreating in infested forests and you live in places where, you know, the hemlock woolly adelgid hasn't been found, but you have hemlock trees, you know, bear that in mind. You know, think about changing your clothes and before you go out into your woods. Similarly with harvests, this is the time of year where you can spread hemlock woolly adelgid on harvesting equipment, on your clothing, those sorts of things. So just being mindful of that if you're moving between long distances between hemlock stands, you're a potential vector this time of year of that pest. And it only takes one because they're all females.
Go ahead, Patty.
If I could put a plug in that, you know, going forward with what Allison's saying, we're all encouraging people during these times to get outside, and it would help us, it would help Allison. Educate yourself on tree species and then educate yourself on these bugs, these invasive plants and insects, and let people know and, you know, call us up, call Allison up, call our entomologists or pathologists up, and, you know, really kind of be aware, and that would truly help the trees of Maine.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that, Patty. And we will be providing links to resources on the Maine Calling Facebook page and on the Maine Calling webpage. So links especially to the your department and the resources available there. A quick email from Steve. He says, please point out that in Aroostook County, we still haven't had enough climate change for planting catalpa or hickory trees. We heard Todd Robbins recommend those for Cape Elizabeth in southern Maine, but something to keep in mind if you live in northern Maine. We're going to go to Jack, who's calling from Wallagrass. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. The problem I seem to be having is no matter what nursery I go to, I can only get maple trees and such that are on grafted stock. And I have not had very good success even bending over backwards trying to keep them going more than a year. And eventually I went out into the woods, found a couple of saplings, I presume they were maple, that were about less than a foot tall. And I'm in my second year, but I'm frustrated that the local nurseries just don't seem to support anything other than grafted. And I like your comments.
Patty?
Yeah, Jack, thanks for that. And to be honest, I wasn't aware of that. And, you know, a limiting factor we have right now is getting nursery stock trees. I mean, that we're losing nurseries. It's getting harder and harder to get the trees we want. And I can look into that. I wasn't aware that it was such a high proportion of grafted stock.
Great. Jack, thanks so much for your call today. We'll go to Ernie, who's calling from Chibeague Island. Hi, Ernie. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I wanted to talk about invasives. One of the worst invasives that we have here on Chibeague, and I'm sure I know on Little Chibeague also, is the bittersweet. We have a lot of bittersweet, and it strangles trees. We lost a tremendous tree. In fact, next door to me, there's a stand of maples that have been strangled by it. And I was going to tell wanted to tell people that whenever I go out and take my dog for a walk, I carry a pair of those small bush clippers. And when I happen to see walk by some bittersweet strangling a small tree, or ash tree, or maple, or oak, or whatever, I snip it off. And in an effort to try to give those trees a head start.
Well, thank you, Ernie, for that service, Patty.
If I could add to that. So, Ernie, you're awesome. I mean, if anytime you go out in the woods, you should have a good pair of boots on and some clippers. And doing what you're doing is a good thing. And I like to say, I like to hang what I've cut up in the trees as a warning to the other bittersweet in the area. Like, stay away. But it's a problem, and it's a with these invasives, if Nancy were still on, she'd be telling you it's a constant battle. It's not a one-and-done thing, but you're doing good by being aware of what it is and taking action to control it.
Also, if people want to go to the extreme, goats are really good at removing bittersweet. They love to chew on it, and another invasive that we have that's spreading very rapidly is the boxwood, and the birds spreading it with the berries, and they're spreading it out good. And we have here where I live, I have quite an extensive stand of hardwoods, maples mostly, swamp maples, and my neighbors, not mine, but... The boxwood is taken over underneath it. And we also had, a couple of years ago, I noticed a lot of needle thinning on our pines here. And I'm just wondering if that's still a problem elsewhere and if it's still growing.
I can speak to that last if you'd like. So... Yeah, and the white pine in particular, if that's what you're talking about, there is a complex of fungal diseases that's been at an epidemic level for over a dozen years now. We do get little bits of a break when we have a drier spring, but the amount of disease pressure out there is so high that we still see annual defoliation of the white pines in sort of the June through July period from those fungal disease. And it is a significant concern, and it's region-wide.
Ernie, thank you so much for calling in. We do need to take another quick break. If you have questions, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Champlain College Online, helping New Englanders prepare for what's next. Champlain.edu/New England.
This week on Maine's Political Pulse, the Biden administration's massive pandemic relief proposal will funnel billions of dollars to Maine. We'll break down where that money is going and how it can be used. Also, the latest from the Maine legislature. Join me, Steve Missler, and Mal Leary for Maine's Political Pulse. Listen to the broadcast version during its new time at 5:35 on Fridays or online anytime at mainepublic.org/pulse.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing Maine's trees and how you can help them thrive. My guests are state entomologist Allison Canody and state forester Patty Cormier. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're really quick, we might be able to get an email in to talk@mainepublic.org. Patty, we started with a great trivia question, which was how many trees are in Maine. I'm going to ask you another one. Of those 23.5 billion trees, if people missed the beginning of the program, amazing number. What percentage of those are seedlings or saplings as opposed to bigger trees?
So in Maine, it's kind of a third. So the composition of seedling saplings, and we're talking, you know, up to an inch in diameter. That's about 32%. Then you have the next breakdown is the pole timber, which goes up to 5-6 inches, and that's another 32%. And then the larger sawed timber, and that's another 32-33%. So it's fairly, our inventory numbers show that it's a fairly even split amongst the sizes.
Mm. An email here from Michael. Many of the native trees living in Maine have lifespans of hundreds of years. Is there a place in Maine we can go to see trees older than our grandmothers? Patty, is there any kind of guide to some of the more spectacular old trees in Maine?
Yeah, there's. I believe you could, if you Googled old growth in Maine, you would find specific areas. One that comes to mind is Gulf Haggis. There's a great stand of this virgin timber. I know living in Farmington, we have a three-acre stand here of old-growth pine and hemlock and yellow birch. And there are pockets around. And, you know, obviously due to our history of the forests of Maine, much of the state has been harvested once or twice, and that is a component that is a little bit harder to find, but they're out there. And I know you go to Gulf Haggis, and it's just absolutely beautiful to see.
Wonderful.
Those big old trees.
One of the many reasons to go to Gulf Haggis. Let's see.
Exactly.
We'll go to Josh in Brunswick. Hi, Josh. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Good morning. Thanks. There's a forest in back of my house in Brunswick, coastal area, and there's a few hemlocks that mature hemlocks that have recently snapped during storms. And I'm wondering if they're affected by the woolly adelgid and if there's anything I can look for to see what's going on. And if there is a problem with that insect, if there's anything that can be done, it's on public land, publicly owned land.
Okay. Allison?
So hemlock woolly adelgid won't cause tree snap itself. It can weaken the trees and make them more vulnerable to fungal agents, but it does not actually lead to the tree snap. But you can, you know, that's kind of ironic, but the easiest time to see whether a hemlock stand has hemlock woolly adelgid is when the foliage is down by the ground. So a lot of times we like to look, you know, in the trails when, you know, after the winter when porcupines and whatnot have dropped the ends of twigs down on the ground, or after in harvest, look for hemlock woolly adelgid because you have a lot of that branch material down. What you look for is the white woolly masses on the undersides of the twigs towards the ends of the twigs. It tends to be on the new growth every year, and so it tends to be towards the ends of the twigs. And those are really small. They're like an eighth inch in diameter or so. So really pretty tiny. You need to often look closely, but if it is a heavy population, you really don't. As far as what can be done, we do have a number of biological control organisms that have been released in Maine that may help with the perpetuation of hemlock in the forest. They are predator beetles that feed on hemlock woolly adelgid. Those are not generally available from the public, although there is a species that people can buy called Tasagis gymnus sugi. There's a supplier in Pennsylvania. You do need a permit to import those from the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. But we don't know for certain that what we have in the mix for biocontrol is going to be enough to keep those mature hemlocks in the forest. There are chemicals that can be used to treat hemlock woolly adelgid infestations, but it's not something that we generally need to do in the forests of Maine because trees will regrow. It is something that's done quite a bit in forests in more southern areas where the hemlock succumb much more rapidly to hemlock woolly adelgid.
All right. Thank you, Josh, for your call. Joan on Facebook asks, can you discuss the balance between using pesticides to help save the trees versus the damage to the ecosystem of critters dependent on the trees, insects, birds, etc.? Patty, I'm going to turn to you on this. You know, we were talking earlier about emerald ash borer and how people can pre-treat their trees to try to save them. How do we think about this balance?
you want me to cover that, Patty? Or?
Yeah, go ahead. I can add to it.
Okay. So it is a balance as far as the insecticides themselves. I mean, insecticides kill insects. That's in the name, right? Some of them are also harmful to other types of organisms. You know, it's really variable. There's a whole lot of different types of insecticides out there. Certainly, the rate of destruction of things like ash is also harming the wildlife that's dependent on those trees. So that's something to bear in mind. Pesticides are something to use sort of as a last resort. It's not something that we recommend just going out and, you know, treating all the trees that are affected by these invasive insects. They can be part of the solution, though, as far as maintaining trees on the landscape as we work towards solutions for these invasive species.
And if I could just add to that, you know, the use of chemicals is a very, it's an emotional, it's a polarizing issue. And really what it comes down to is risk versus reward. And sometimes there are stop gaps in place regulatory wise of how much should be used, where it can be used, and what conditions, that kind of thing. And if those are followed, that's the point. If those are followed, there shouldn't be harm. But, you know, it's looking at the alternatives. Sometimes if we don't use some of these chemicals, we are not going to like what the alternatives are for our forest and the invasives that are marching in.
Mm. Mary from Limerick, go ahead. And if you could be quick, that would be great. We're tight on time.
Oh, sure. Thank you for the call. Love the show. Well, we have a little piece of property in Limerick, only 2.5 acres. 30 years ago, my husband let part of it grow into fields, and 30 years later, we now have our own small little forest with white pine and hardwoods, and we even let our neighbor come and pull up some of these saplings 30 years ago, and she has a nice border on her property, and it's just a really passive way to create a little forest right on your own backyard, and I just wanted to add that.
All you need is time, right, Mary?
All we needed was a little bit of time, yes. But animals and birds.
Wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing that. We're going to go to Daniel, who sent an email. He says he's an arborist. His company is called Corvus Tree Works. He's in Alna. And he says, I'd like to put in a plug for the creation of habitat spars. The idea is when a tree is removed, we leave a standing section of trunk short enough to be safe to create habitat for insects, and which in turn food source for struggling bird populations. When a customer requests a habitat spar, I carve the small hollows into the trunk and carve the top to look like a natural fracture. Patty, do you like that idea?
I love that idea. And any of our, how-to manuals for working with your woods, working in the forest, it's also looking at habitat. And we always say to leave dead trees with holes in them for habitat. And so he's giving another great tool to think about.
Sure. And we have a question from Cliff on Little Deer Isle. He says a lot of dead trees which have fallen, and he wants to know if he should clear them. And you're saying no.
Well, then we get down to what's the objective, and you got to, it's always a complex answer, right? So is there a fire danger too? You don't want to leave too many dead standing stems because you're at risk for fuel load. So it's kind of that balance. If you want a lot of critters and they're of the right size, then leave them. But if they're a hazard, you should take them down.
All right. And Patty, I just want to quickly say that we have so many calls and questions coming in that we're not going to get to in this hour. We're going to recommend that people try to find their local tree warden. And if that person does not help you, go ahead and call the Forest Service. Patty and Allison and others there will take your calls. And Patty, we're going to end with one more trivia question. I heard there's a scratch and sniff tree. What is it?
That's right. That's yellow birch. If you ever see a lumberman chewing on a twig, it's likely yellow birch. So if you scratch the bark of a limb, and you're going to smell wintergreen. And I wanted to give you another factoid that I don't know why I know this, but historically witches' brooms were made out of ash. So that's another reason why we don't want to lose our ash component.
Well, thank you all both so much for being with us. Such a popular program. And I apologize to all of you whose question we couldn't get to. Patty Cormier, the Maine State Forester, and Allison Canody, our state entomologist. Today's sound engineer was John Keimel with Stella Mars. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.